I'll call the meeting to order and have a couple of announcements. We are not going to vote on 3713, so I'm really not going to move it, but we are going to have testimony about the fiscal notes on that bill, and we will presumably vote on it tomorrow. Also, Thiessen's PACE bill will not be heard tonight, and the Huntley 3047 bill will also not be heard tonight. And with that, some of you may know that House File 3713 allows the state of Minnesota to start medical assistance for adults without children on April 1st of 2010. The federal reform bill has that in it, and it would allow us to take adults without children, move them into medical assistance up to 133% of poverty. What my bill does is move it up to 75% of poverty, with the idea that that would basically take care of the GAMC population and also a segment of the Minnesota care population. There is, I don't know, 26,000 or so people on Minnesota care that are below 75% of poverty. We would, of course, be required to pay a state match, and there's some dispute. My understanding is that the state match would be the usual 50% rate and not the stimulus rate, but the Senate thinks the other way, and so we're going to have that straightened out. They think that it would be at the 62% federal match, and the way I read the bill, it would be at the 50% match. But that, of course, means we have to come up with our half or our 42%. And with that, I would invite Brian Osberg and George Hoffman to come and discuss the their fiscal runs on this. There's some differences from what I think was in there, but we'll hear from them. So welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Brian Osberg, the State Medicaid Director, and let me give you a little overview of the issue in terms of what's in the reform bill relating to the early option, and then Mr. Hoffman will discuss the financial analysis that he is, that he has done. Now, based on what was signed by the President this week, we have a good sense of what is available to the states in terms of an early option, but there's a lot of unknowns to it. We do know that the option is available to the states anytime after April 1st of this year. We do know that it's 50% match that is available. We were hoping that we would have the enhanced match of 61.59% during the time in which we had the enhanced match, but that's not going to be the case because that enhanced match does not apply to any expansion population, and this would be an expansion population. What we don't know is quite a bit, and that is because CMS has not yet interpreted what exactly this means. CMS is going to hopefully soon, and very soon, because we're asking for clarification as soon as possible, they're going to determine exactly what benefit package we're talking about and what eligibility criteria we're talking about. Because what's not clear in the bill at all is to whether or not we're talking about a Medicaid option based on current Medicaid rules and criteria or the future one rules and criteria that go into effect 2014. There's a big difference. For example, under current medical assistance, there's an asset test under current Medicaid. In 2014, there is not. On current Medicaid, you have some flexibility in terms of how you calculate the 133% or 75% in terms of the income. You have the ability to disregard certain income. In the new criteria in 2014, there will not be that flexibility. You have to calculate income based on what's the modified adjusted gross income. And so the states will not have any flexibility at all. So we have no idea at this point how exactly CMS is going to structure the rules around this early option. And we're hoping that that'll happen as soon as possible. As I said, we're requesting that information. We know that, however, that our current Minnesota Care arrangement would not be a good fit in terms of either the current Medicaid rules or the future ones. GAMC, the old GAMC program, would be closer, but we know that's not going to be a true fit either. We know that would not be the same eligibility or benefits that would be structured under Medicaid. So either way, we're going to have to change this and establish a new major program. It'd be nice, and I know, Mr. Chair, that you were hoping that we could simply switch GAMC, the old model, into a new Medicaid model. You know, that would be ideal, but that is not possible. Now, so it will take us some time, and I think we discussed that with you, Mr. Chair, as to what it would take, not just in terms of systems, but in terms of designing and operationalizing something like this. And we could talk about that in more detail if you wish. But with that, Mr. Chairman, I'll ask Mr. Hoffman to...
Representative Murphy has a question, but before that, if we're allowed to do this on April 1st, but we can't get all the processing done, currently on medical assistance, if somebody has some medical expenses before they get formally enrolled, we have a three-month look back. So if we finally got the paperwork done, let's say by July 1st, could we look back for 3 months for any expenses that had occurred during that time and collect it? Do you know if that's in the new reform bill or not?
Mr. Chair, yes, we would expect that it would be a retroactive eligibility of 3 months. That would be one of the criterion for eligibility.
So then, even if we couldn't get the paperwork processed instantly, we would still get at least a three-month look back.
Mr. Chair?
Not prior to the effective date of our taking the option.
No. Yeah, Mr. Chair, not until this is in place. That's true. Yeah. You were talking about once the program is in place.
Right.
There's a three-month look back.
Or whatever that took, we would still get 3 months before that covered.
Mr. Chair, I would believe that it would be the case.
Okay. Mr. Hoffman, did you look like you wanted to make a comment on that?
My thought is that we'd probably not be able to cover any service dates prior to the effective date of our taking the option. So I don't think we'd be able to cover something if our taking the option were effective July 1st. I suspect it couldn't cover any services rendered prior to July 1st.
And Mr. Hoffman, what do you mean by taking the option?
Well, there would be a legal effective date when this option went into effect for Minnesota.
Well, what if we said the legal effective date was April 1st?
Well, then that would avoid the issue.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a couple of questions. I'm curious about the confusion about CMS and the rules. Since they're saying 2014, we're going to have some new rules for Medicaid, but it's 2010, and I'm wondering what is going into your thinking in terms of why we would consider the new rules when they're 4 years out, and why we wouldn't assume, I know we shouldn't assume, but why the assumption wouldn't be made that we're working within the current rules.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, in fact, that's what we're trying to figure out, but the thinking is that they're saying you have the option, states have the option to do 133% early, so they're implying that it's based on the future rules. That's what their implication is. But there's nothing in the law that states under what rules will this operate. So our interpretation so far is that it's not clear. And that's what we're hoping to get that clarified from CMS real soon. So the implication is that it's going to be based on future criteria, where there will not be an asset test, for example. But we cannot make that assumption until we get that clarified by CMS, which, as I said, will hopefully be soon.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Murphy.
Thanks. Just one more. I've heard the description used, a whole new program, now a few times in reference to this option. And Medicaid is a program that's been around since 1965, and it is a categorical program, as we know. So I'm wondering if when you say or others are saying it's a whole new program, are you talking about a whole new category of people that are going to be considered eligible for this? Or are you making reference to some other something or other that we don't know about yet? Because it's an old program.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, we have a good sense of who we're talking about. Again, we don't know how we're going to calculate the 133% or the 75%, whether it's based on, again, the new rules or the current rules. But it'll be a modification from what we have today. It's everything else that we're talking about. It's all the provisions that now instead of a state-funded program where there's no federal rules or criteria, now we're subject to all of the Medicaid rules and criteria, and there are a lot. As you know, there are a lot of rules that we have to abide by. So we got to make sure, and of course we do have experience in running a Medicaid program, but we don't necessarily have experience running a Medicaid program under this current set of criteria. And so we would assume a lot of it would be similar. For example, they've also have provided in the new legislation additional benefits, for example, requiring coverage for freestanding birthing centers. We don't know what the effective date is that going to be. Is that going to be now if we select this option, or is that going to be in 2014? No one has able to tell us that yet. Those are the kind of things we have to find out. What are we subject to? What are our options around the benefits piece, for example? We know we have something that's called a benchmark benefit set. Now, they're changing that, though, to include mental health services and drugs. Before, up to this point, for example, states have the option for a program like this. And other states have developed a waiver arrangement to cover adults without kids. We're one of three states that have all state dollars to cover this population. There's about 10 states, so-called expansion states, that have used Medicaid money to cover adults without kids over time. And so the question is what exactly will this entail in terms of the new rules?
And Mr. Chair,
Representative Murphy.
Just for clarification then, so when the phrase is used, a whole new program, maybe is a more applicable to inside DHS and CMS, there's a whole new program, system program, computer program, et cetera, that needs to be created, because Medicaid's not a whole new program, right? So maybe the reference is to a whole new program inside the world in which we're working.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, we have many Medicaid programs today. We have medical assistance for employed persons with disabilities. We have a family planning program. We have breast and cervical cancer program. We have program long-term care program. Mm-hmm. We have a program for seniors. We have a program for children. We have a program for parents. We have a program for pregnant women. We have many, many medical assistance programs. That's what I mean by this would be another program. We have 27 programs that we operate.
Okay.
And so this will be a major program that we need to design, develop, then implement and introduce this. Again, it will be a variation of GAMC, but the old GAMC, but clearly now we're subject to a whole different set of rules.
Okay, thanks.
Okay. Representative Thiessen.
So I just want to, because this, I thank you for this line of questioning, because this makes no sense to me at all. That, I mean, we have an adult Medicaid program, right? So for adults without kids, why would these folks, aside from all the points you're making about we don't know if it's going to be 2014, which I don't know how you could do that because there won't be rules till 2014. So I would assume that it would be the 2010 program. And if that's the case, why can't you just include these people in the Medicaid program? Why do you have to create all this new stuff? It sounds to me like you're making excuses for delaying this.
Mr. Chair, Representative
Mr. Osborne.
Said, no, we're not. There's
well, you're not giving a good answer.
I'm not suggesting that it's easy. Or I'm not doing that either. Not at all. Why would I want to do that?
Well, okay. So what exactly would we have to change? Why couldn't we just include these folks in with our adult Medicaid program? Aside from the thing about you got to get guidance, whether it's 2010 or 2014. So, and that's where you started every time. So let's set that aside. Assuming it's 2010, what more would you have to do except apply the criteria that exists for adults with children?
Mr. Asberg.
Mr. Chair and Representative Thiessen, there's a number of things that we'd probably have to look at. One is, again, is to what exactly we're going to cover in terms of the benefit side.
Do you know what that is?
That's one thing the committee and legislature is going to have to think about, is exactly what you want to cover. You have a lot of options around what you can cover, more so than what you do in a Medicaid program for parents, for example. So you got to think about that. Eligibility may be different in this case. There's also the interaction with our disabilities program. This will allow, covering adults without kids will actually help enroll people into the program before they actually have a disability. There's a need to think about the interaction about that. There's the issue about medical spend down. There's a lot of issues that have to be thought about. And we can't do that on our own. I'm not suggesting that it can't be designed and thought about and structured during the next few months or while you're in session. I'm not suggesting that. I'm suggesting that it has to be thought through exactly how we're going to structure this for this population.
So, Mr. Chair, I guess my question is, can't we just accept the same criteria that we have for adults without children?
Mr. Chair, Representative Thiessen, we aren't aware of that. We have been told by CMS that we can do that. We will find out whether or not what we can do in terms of the benefit side and the eligibility side. That will give us a great deal of clarification about how we can structure this, and we'll bring that back to you and work with the legislature in structuring the most appropriate benefit and eligibility provisions once we know what are required and once we know what we have some discretion.
Representative Hodge.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Asberg, did you have to create a whole new system for the proposed transitional Minnesota Care program?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hosh, we did have to do that. We did have to structure a new arrangement that was specifically transitional Minnesota Care, and we developed the nuances of doing that. That was, again, the key to that is that that's a state-funded program. It's not subject to medical assistance or Medicaid rules. When we have a state-funded program, we can do anything that we wish. Frankly, we're on a Medicaid situation, now we're talking about a whole different set of criteria by which we have to structure this arrangement.
Representative Hodge.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Asberg, I found it interesting that we have 27 different programs. I think it's, you know, years and years of trying to fill the cracks, and what I'm reluctant to say is a system. If we were to do this early enrollment, would there be any ability to eliminate some of those 27 programs? And instead of having to follow up with another question, my follow-up would be as the federal reforms kick in starting in 2014, do you anticipate some of those 27 programs being reduced or eliminated?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hosh, very good question. I don't know in terms of what we could do. We could possibly eliminate Minnesota Care option for this population. That way you just have Medicaid for that population, have a bright line. That's one thing you could do. Otherwise, you will have a Minnesota Care option still for adults without kids. So you could do that if you wish. That is not. You still didn't have adults without kids between 75% and 250% in Minnesota Care. So you don't eliminate that program, but you eliminate part of it. Hopefully, this one opportunity in this legislation is to clarify our programs. Not only clarify eligibility criteria, because it does eliminate the asset test, for example. It does say the only way you can calculate income is based on adjusted gross income, and not all these income deductions we have and disregards we have today. They'll simplify that. And also, under the legislation, what you'll have is this. You'll have a Medicaid program for adults without kids, parents, and children, and then you will have adults, both parents and adults without kids, going to the insurance exchange over 133%, up to 400%, and all you will have in Minnesota Care is our kids, up to 275%, because this bill does not fold kids into the exchange. We have a maintenance of effort requirement for our CHIP program until 2019. And so this legislation will not allow, but what we could do, the legislature could do, is simply say put those kids into the exchange anyway and then wrap around coverage, making sure we have what we call a child teen checkup, early and periodic screening, diagnosis and treatment, or EPSDT program, that we maintain the same benefit structure but allow kids to be enrolled through the exchange. That way you would not have a Minnesota Care program at all. You would have medical assistance and you'd have the exchange. You could structure that in 2014. So we've been thinking about all those possibilities. This would, my mind, allow us to simplify eligibility and enrollment. If we're going to have an individual mandate for people, we better have the ability to make it easy for people to get into programs. And that's what we hope that would be done, certainly.
Just to make it more confusing, the maintenance of effort, I mean, there's such a complex mixture of things in Minnesota Care for families with kids between medical assistance and Minnesota Care, and how you're ever going to figure out what our maintenance of effort is. I'm sure the feds will tell us what it is. But
Mr. Chair, unfortunately, we have a good sense of what that is, and it's very, very restrictive. It's as restrictive as it is under the current stimulus ARRA legislation. And that is that we cannot change any standards, methods, or procedures around eligibility. Last year, the legislature changed the level of care criteria for long-term care coverage, and because we're going to put that into effect after the MOE was lifted. The MOE now, it goes through 2014, up to 2014. So we have to buy back that change that we made last year and other things. We would not have the ability to do anything around eligibility until 2014. Some people think that's great, and some people think, well, that ties our hands as to what we can do, especially around things like procedures. We argued, of course, we've been trying to influence this legislation over the last 6 to 8 months. We'd argue that give us some flexibility around at least the procedural side to determine what's the best eligibility criteria for long-term care. They would not go there. So we cannot, the only place that where there's some flexibility or some opt-out of maintenance of effort is for adults without kids. There's not a maintenance of effort for adults without kids in our program, for example, Minnesota Care program, as long as we can demonstrate that we're poor, which I'm afraid we can do. So we can opt out of that maintenance of effort provision. Otherwise, we have a maintenance of effort provision for all categories, not just for parents and kids and adults without kids, but people with disabilities and for seniors.
Okay, Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Osberg, I want to go back to the 27 Medicaid programs, because I'm also amazed to hear that there are 27 of them, and I want to understand a little bit more what it means that there are 27 different programs. I mean, does this mean that you have groups of employees who work exclusively on these different programs? I mean, I guess I'd like to know how many people work on each program. Maybe this is something you could give us in writing.
Sure.
I mean, it amazes me. I this is my second term on Health and Human Services. I'm on both policy and finance, and I don't know this, and I don't know how many of us did, and I'm not sure why that is, but I'd really like to know what this means in real concrete terms, how many people, what they're doing on these separate programs, or how much overlap there is between the programs, and, you know, why does it mean that we have 27 different staffs of people working on these programs?
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, no, it does not. What it means is that we have 27 products or programs that, based on populations primarily that we serve. Within Minnesota Care, for example, we have a number of different programs, depending on whether or not their income or what whether or not they're indeed pregnant women or children. It's 27 programs or products, maybe it's a better way of putting it. And it's because, frankly, what Minnesota has done over the years is taken advantage of every opportunity. For example, the federal government has put in front of us in terms of covering people. One of the reasons we have a complicated set of programs is that we have taken advantage of all the available options to us. And we have, the federal government has introduced these options bit by bit. We've not had the opportunity to, and I don't think they're going to necessarily restructure all that at this point either. But we don't have 27 different staffs working on this. But when we structure these arrangements, we do have our people. In fact, we don't have a GAMC staff or Medicaid staff or Minnesota Care staff around, of course, determining eligibility. But in terms of policy, our eligibility policy people and our contract and insurer contracting people all work on these programs and products. And so we can break down what we're talking about in terms of different categories of people that we serve. But it is quite extensive. And remember, we have three major programs up to this point, GAMC, Minnesota Care, and medical assistance, but within that we have many products and programs that are specific to certain populations or specific to certain situations like family planning or breast and cervical cancer or employed persons with disabilities programs for undocumented pregnant women, for example. We have programs for infants that's a little different than 0 to 2, then for kids, we have programmed. I can go on and on how we've structured this. But again, it's primarily in order to take advantage of what's available to us in terms of coverage.
Mr. Osberg, if you could get us sort of a brief outline of those 27 programs, and also I've seen the, at some point in my career here, the differences depending how old a kid is, and if they get into, if they're 0 to 2, they're in one program. If they're 2 to 5 or something, they're in another program. And it's mind-boggling how many different things there are. So if you could get us sure. That sheet too, I would appreciate it.
We would do
and
that.
And are there another? Yeah, Representative Abler. And then we're going to go on, I think, to Mr. Hoffman.
That's what I was hoping for, too. But I have just two questions. From if we have to roll back the changes we made with eligibility or at least the amount, levels of service, is there another deficit you're going to tell us about that we have to be responsible for in this starting in 2011? You mentioned that there's been some changes that MOE went through 2014 now. Okay. We're holding out our changes till 2011. January 1st, is there going to be news about more money we can't have saved that we took?
Well, Mr.
Osberg.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I think we've accounted for that for this biennium. All of the MOEs, I believe, we've accounted for that, have we not?
In the
Mr. Hoffman.
In the estimate of what we stand to gain from the extension of the enhanced match, we have allowed for what we would lose in the current biennium. If that MOE is extended to 2014, there will be somewhat greater costs than we have allowed so far in the next biennium.
All right, so at least we're good for this biennium. Just one more bigger problem for the future. So we did take savings in the tails that we don't get to keep, and that'll be in the November forecast then, probably.
Representative Thiessen.
But we get out of that because we're in a deficit.
No, Mr. Chair, Representative Thiessen, what we get out of is the maintenance of effort provision, not necessarily.
That's what he was asking about.
No. I'm talking about maintenance of effort around eligibility for adults without kids, not maintenance of effort in terms of eligibility standards, methods, and procedures. That's what I thought Representative Abler was asking about, is those provisions, such as the level of care criteria, and there's other such MOE provisions. We don't have any assumption that we're going to reduce. Well, again, that's a different subject as to what we're going to do in terms of reducing coverage for adults without kids.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Representative.
I don't mean to confuse people. It just sounds like if we can't change standards, methods, and procedures as we did effective January 1st of 2011, then those are going to bounce, and we're going to have to pay for those. That's what I was
Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, that's true.
Okay. And that'll be not news we want to hear. And then another question. We just on the governor's about to sign the whatever you call the program now, the General Assistance Medical Care new thing, with the CCOs in there. Are we allowed to do something like that? The bill before us is just simply straight MA for these people. Are we allowed to create a CCO option and take some savings, or ACO or something, and take savings like we did, give the hospitals a pot of money or give somebody a pot of money and manage them?
Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, that's a good question. This new legislation allows greater flexibility around how we're going to structure payment for providers. What it does is that allow us to, and we already have authority to do a healthcare home type of arrangement, what we call primary care coordination. And we expect that we can apply the health care. Again, one question that the committee and the legislature needs to address is whether or not this population will be served through managed care arrangements or fee-for-service. That's one thing that, and the implication here is that this would be managed care contracts that is the vehicle by which we'd serve this population. But I'm not sure if that's been fully thought through. But we would have the ability to do health care home, for example, and we would have the ability to seek, because this CMS is much more open to allowing for different models of payment. And up to this point, they've been very strict about not being able to bundle payments, for example, to providers. But now we see a different approach and different mindset around that from CMS. And the legislation is going to give us some flexibility, hopefully for Medicare to participate in some of our arrangements, and that we're going to pursue that angle. We're going to go after what's called the Advanced Primary Care Grant. We're allows Medicare to participate in some of the reform items that we have. And so we're hoping that we can do at some point, an accountable care organization type of model under not just this program, but under Medicaid overall.
Well, Mr. Osberg, you can correct me, but it's my understanding that the accountable care organization model still has an insurance company taking insurance risk, and so that it would be presumably in the PMAP system, unlike the CCOs we're talking about, which is a completely different thing, and there's no insurance company involved.
Again, Mr. Chair, what we're hearing is that there'll be more flexibility for allowing us to do direct contracting with providers to share risk, and so we're hopeful of that. Well, of course, they talk mostly about pilots and demonstrations in in the new reform legislation around Medicare doing that and allowing Medicaid to do that. But we're hoping that we'll get a great deal of flexibility around how we can structure payment arrangements under our fee-for-service side. And managed care organizations now have the ability to do. When we contract with managed care organization for our population, they have the flexibility to structure those arrangements as they wish. That's the beauty of managed care arrangement.
Okay. I think we ought to move on to Mr. Hoffman, talk about the dollars.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, members, I understood that you have a three-page spreadsheet that I furnished to staff.
We all have it.
What is assumed here is that is the estimated fiscal effects if the state adopted this option beginning January 1st of 11. Now, I would stress that I'm not the one who's going to decide when we can do it by, but I took that date as an example, and so you can consider this. You can consider this an illustration. I can change that effective date very easily.
And you're not counting any three-month.
Let me go back to that, Mr. Chairman. The 3 months retro coverage is a benefit to the individual. It is possible that the state, if it makes payments which are equivalent to Medicaid payments and Medicaid eligibility, it is possible to claim federal funding for an extended retroactive period. We already do that when somebody has been on the GAMC program and they get a disability determination after many months, maybe more than a year. They get a favorable disability determination. We establish medical assistance eligibility retroactively to when the disability determination was effective, and we convert all those past GAMC payments into medical assistance payments. So we can go back. That if it's equivalent eligibility and a Medicaid equivalent payment, we can go retroactively for an extended period and claim federal match.
So you can do more than 3 months for that particular group?
Yes, that's correct. And we have. When we established eligibility for SCHIP unborn, basically covering non-citizen pregnant women, we were able to go back more than a year and to claim federal match. When we had finally implemented the systems change for this, we were able to go back more than a year and claim the federal match on the qualifying payments. The hitch is that it has to be Medicaid equivalent eligibility and Medicaid equivalent payments that were made. And we don't have something equivalent in place. So that's where the problem of implementation comes in.
So, but we have people on GAMC now, and they get SSI, and then you can go back and collect 2 years of GAMC payments.
Yes, that's correct. We can do that now,
and that happens
routinely now.
But I'm not following then why this would be a problem in the future if you're saying they're not similar benefits or similar payments.
Well, this is something that the federal government agreed to many years ago, and we'd be having to ask the question again in a new context. Would they accept what exists in the GAMC program? But we're just changing the GAMC program, and so that puts us in a different situation than if we were keeping the GAMC program going. But there would still be issues about whether that old GAMC program was acceptable as a Medicaid look-alike. And as a Medicaid payment, if we subsequently established eligibility for the people receiving it.
Okay. Well, Mr. Hoffman, why don't you go ahead with your financial forecast? And this does not include any retroactivity in it, though.
That's right. It assumes service coverage effective January 1st, 11.
Okay.
It's built out of building blocks of existing program groups. We have an existing forecast for the GAMC population, so we've forecasted similar enrollment and similar costs going in to the Medicaid option. We've also done the same with a couple of pieces of Minnesota Care. One is transitional Minnesota Care managed care. That's the transitional Minnesota Care group in the Minnesota Care managed care program with average enrollment of 10,000 to 12,000 a month. We've used expected costs for that population. We've also taken on the second page adults without kids in Minnesota Care under 75% of poverty, and we've used our forecast, that segment of our forecast, to forecast what they would look like and what they would cost us as a part of this option. And then going back to the beginning again, we've also estimated that the new program will draw in additional people, additional enrollment who would otherwise be uninsured.
And can you give me an estimate of what the out-of-the-woodwork numbers are, percentage-wise, though?
Percentage-wise, they're a... they're a 20 to 25% increase in what we would forecast if we only forecasted based on existing expectations for the existing programs. Now, there are a number of reasons why we would get more. One is that in Minnesota Care, we have a premium, and the new Medicaid option would be free. There wouldn't be any premium process to bump people off of the program if they don't pay, as there is now in Minnesota Care. The benefit would be better than the Minnesota Care benefit. I'm assuming in here that the benefit is approximately the same as the current GAMC benefit, as the past GAMC benefit. And I would point out that that's not as generous as the medical assistance benefit set. And the difference is mainly home care and long-term care services. So if the benefit set were the full medical assistance benefit set, there would be additional costs. And I have not tried to estimate those yet, but I'd say roughly 10 to 20% higher costs if we covered home care in addition, home care and long-term care services. There's also the retro coverage issue. We don't have retro coverage in the GAMC program or in Minnesota Care. The retro coverage would add more months of coverage for the same people. More months of coverage is more average enrollment. There is also a very large number of people on an annual basis who enter and leave, especially the GAMC and Transitional Minnesota Care Program. More than 30,000 people come and go on an annual basis. If we offered a better benefit, a free benefit, we would clearly hold on to some of those people for a longer time. And all of those things go into explaining why we think we would have somewhat higher enrollment in this new option than we would expect to see with the populations in the existing program.
Can I ask you one? I mean, I've gone through this sheet, but in fiscal year 2011, why are the average monthly enrollments about half of what they are in the next 2 years, and they're half of what they actually are?
It's because our normal way of showing this is to show a 12-month average, even though the coverage is only for 6 months, so that we don't have the possible computational confusion of whether an average is an average of 6 months or an average of 12 months. We always use an average of 12 months, even if six of those months are zeros, and that's what you're pointing out. Yeah. In the first year, six of those months are zeros, and so the average enrollment for the 6 months that there would be enrollment is exactly twice the number shown here. The medical assistance totals on the second page sum up the preceding groups, sum up the average enrollment and the costs. and calculate a 50% federal share and 50% state share. And so that would be the cost of the new coverage in the general fund. After that total, we calculate what the savings would be, what the reduction in enrollment and what the savings would be in the Minnesota Care program. And here we are accounting for two groups. One is the transitional Minnesota Care managed care coverage, and the other is the adults without kids up to 75 of poverty. These cost figures, savings figures here, are less than what is shown as the medical assistance costs, mostly because we have allowed an 11% increase for the elimination of the inpatient hospital cap. In Minnesota Care and in the forecast for the existing program, we have the caps. We're assuming we are not able to have those caps in the Medicaid option.
That's the savings 11% increase in spending.
We've allowed an overall 11% increase in the benefit cost. There's also a difference in timing, which makes these numbers are not going to be exactly 11% different. I assumed in the projections that we would start out with a fee-for-service program. The thinking now is that it would be a managed care program. The fiscal differences are small, and they're mostly a matter of timing. We do pay later in a fee-for-service program. We pay earlier when we pay managed care because we pay at about the beginning of the month of coverage. So we have a two-month difference in timing, but in the law, we have a delay of the June managed care payment until July. So that takes away one of the months of difference. And we have a withhold, which is now 9.5% in medical assistance, which we hold out of the calendar year payments and which we don't pay until the following July. And 9.5% is a bit more than a month's worth. And so between those two things, the timing difference is basically canceled out, whether it's going to be fee-for-service or managed care. So I can just say it doesn't make a lot of difference as far as these estimates go, whether the new program is fee-for-service or managed care.
And I have another question on page 2 with the adults without kids for Minnesota Care. In fiscal year 2012, the enrollment is 30,400.
Yes.
And currently, in Minnesota Care, those below 75% of poverty are about 26,000. So is that increase due to the fact that it's a better program, they don't have to pay premiums, so they're not dropping out, or is it because it's coming out of the woodwork?
It's increased enrollment because it's a 2 years later forecast. You have numbers from January of 10. This is a forecast for fiscal 12, basically 2 years later. That's the slope of our enrollment forecast for adults without children in Minnesota Care.
Representative Abler.
I've been here too long. This is actually kind of interesting, and I'm understanding most of it. Just a short question. When you talk about managed care and fee-for-service, why would the state care if they had managed care if they don't save any money on it? What's the benefit to us to use a managed care organization?
Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, there's a lot of discussions around that. Of course, we've had this committee and others about the very thing.
Short answer on this.
But we have we contract managed care organizations. They have ability to manage utilization more effectively, manage costs more effectively than we do in the fee-for-service. Now, we're catching up with that to some degree, but still we don't have the resources, ability to manage health care costs that the health plans have. And so that's why we have a policy where we have enrolled everyone except for people with disabilities in managed care is to try to not only have ability to manage costs, but to broaden the provider network or make sure there's access to the provider network, to make available prevention programs, outreach programs. We don't have any of that for a fee-for-service population. And so there's a lot of differences between managed care and fee-for-service in terms of the value proposition around access cost. And
we should talk about it more, but I just have to ask again. According to Mr. Hoffman, we don't save any money, so there's no savings to the state. There's no savings, and whatever they manage or they do doesn't save anything, at least officially, to make a dent. It seems like if they manage stuff, we think Healthcare Homes is going to save money if we do more coordination, and they do some of that maybe, and it doesn't save any money in that reflects on our costs. When you do fee-for-service, any provider who fills out the form gets to be on the fee-for-service program compared to managed plans which have smaller networks. So I'm just, it's a discussion for later. I'm just puzzled by that, and so I'll talk to you about it some more.
We'll but go over that in some detail with you.
Yeah, thanks.
Mr. Hoffman, why don't you continue?
Okay, the summary is on the third page. The medical assistance costs in the line opposite medical assistance come from the state share in the middle of page two. I'll skip the transfer parts and go on to Minnesota Care for the moment. I'll come back to the transfers. The Minnesota Care savings of $109 million comes from the bottom of page two. That's the same number. Now, the Minnesota Care savings shown here are the savings we would get out of the base Minnesota Care forecast without the addition of the cost expected to result in our February forecast from a lot of the GAMC population moving into Minnesota Care. That's not in the first line after Minnesota Care. So we add in the next line, we show expected savings against those costs of the shift of the GAMC population to Minnesota Care, because if we cover them under a Medicaid option, we won't have to cover them under Minnesota Care. I wanted to keep those two parts separate. So we didn't integrate it into the other Minnesota Care savings. We just put it here in the summary. So we have substantial Minnesota Care savings now. If you add those two lines, in fiscal 12, $299 million of savings in the regular Minnesota Care program, and $239 million of savings because the GAMC population is accommodated elsewhere. But we have a big deficit in the Minnesota Care program, and we can't save money that we don't have. So we subtract the deficit from, we offset the deficit against the savings. And then once the deficit has been resolved, this option is enough to cover the deficit in all 3 years. When the deficit is resolved, we again have to make a $48 million a year transfer from healthcare access to the general fund. And so we show the cost of the $48 million transfer.
The current law that says we should cover the general fund must cover the deficit in the healthcare access fund terminates on June 30th, 2011.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. That's why, but that doesn't affect the $48 million transfer.
No.
So that's why we show the $48 million in all 3 years. In fiscal 11, we show that with the deficit resolved, the general fund does not have to transfer $98 million to the healthcare access fund. So avoidance of that transfer from the general fund to healthcare access is shown as a decrease in the general fund and an increase in the healthcare access fund.
Representative Hosh is first, and then Representative Gottwald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
St. Cloud people are.
Mr. Chair, I am not a St. Cloud person.
Oh.
I'm from St. Joseph. And I go west from there. So, but Mr. Hoffman, right now, do we, in our forecast, in our budget forecast, do we anticipate the repayment of the healthcare access fund deficit?
No, we show a healthcare access deficit in the forecast. The healthcare access fund balance shows a deficit. And this is these numbers represent the same values as are currently shown as the healthcare access deficit. We show the fund balance shows a deficit of 800 and some million at the end of 13. I broke that out into each of the years, but it's based on the same numbers.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Hoffman, I'm just trying to make sure that we're comparing apples to apples, because I mean, much of what we do here is whatever comes out in the November or the February forecast, that's what we budget off of. And I mean, if we play by the same rules, whether it's the forecast assumes repayment of the deficit to get the healthcare access fund in balance, or when we're trying to compare what the early enrollment means by not assuming that repayment. I don't care which way we do it, but I think right now we're kind of comparing apples to oranges. If we were to play by the same rules as how we do our forecast, where we just show the deficit in the healthcare access fund as it is, it looks like the total cost to all funds then becomes a positive impact. Am I reading things wrong?
Yes. No, you are.
Okay, thank you.
You're reading it correctly. I would, Mr. Chairman, go back to the principle that we can't save money we don't have. And I would not want to identify savings from a change and not acknowledge in some form that there was still a deficit in the healthcare access fund. Obviously, the legislature can choose if it wants, or the legislature and the administration can choose if they want to leave a deficit in the healthcare access fund in the next biennium, but our job is to identify where things stand. We don't tell you what to do, but we want to show you how the numbers work.
And Mr. Chair and Mr. Hoffman, I'm not disagreeing with the approach you're taking. I mean, it's the more fiscally responsible approach to take. I just want to make sure we're apples to apples. You know, if we're comparing it this way to determine the impact of MA early enrollment, we should also try to consider the same thing when we do our forecasting for expenditures, and assume, if we're assuming repayment of the healthcare access fund deficit, we should do the same thing in our forecast then. If we did that, then we would see the true net impact under the same assumptions, accounting assumptions. But right now, this document differs substantially from how we assume our expenditures of our funds from our forecasted documents.
Okay, let's go to Representative Gottwald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, Representative Hoshan ask some of what I had to ask, but Mr. Chair, Mr. Hoffman, this whole projection assumes Minnesota Care status quo, no changes whatsoever, correct? Same benefit level, same enrollment.
This projection assumes that everybody who can qualify for this MA option in Minnesota Care is moved into this MA option. It assumes we don't offer a choice, allowing people to stay in Minnesota Care at 100% state cost versus being in medical assistance at 50% state cost.
Right. So if you're at that income level, you're...
Otherwise, what you say is correct. It assumes no other changes in Minnesota Care.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Hoffman, if you could kind of finish up. I think we're probably going to have you back again later, but if you could finish up, because we have a number of other bills to do.
Having talked about the transfers, I'm at the bottom line, Mr. Chairman, and I'm happy to stop there.
Representative Abler has a question.
Well, on the bill we did today showed up in the Ways and Means resolution as a savings of $146 million, I think, in this biennium. There's some savings this biennium from the bill we did today. Would that add to the cost then on this sheet on the bottom line?
Mr. Hoffman.
The main difference in the bottom line from the passage of the GAMC bill would be that the GAMC bill makes almost $100 million a year, has funding of $100 million a year approximately for the GAMC program in each year of 12 and 13. And if that were law and we did a fiscal note now, we would count that $100 million a year roughly as available for the cost of this general fund option, and that would be the main fiscal difference that the passage of that bill would make in the bottom line on this estimate.
Just and then Representative Abler. And there were some savings this biennium, I think, because of that effort over current law. How would that show up in this?
It would basically wash out between a reduced deficit for the health care access fund, but a reduced level of savings for avoiding the shift of GAMC costs to the Minnesota Care program.
That's good enough now. Thank you very much.
And just before you we finish up here, Mr. Osberg, I'm concerned about the retroactivity. If you could work on, is there something we might need to change in our sort of interim GAMC program to make it more likely that we would get as much retroactivity as we could? And then Mr. Hoffman is, things are changing very rapidly, and how are you ever going to be able to get to all the fiscal notes that we'll need to know before the end of session if we try to adapt to federal law?
Mr. Chairman, I'm assuming you mean if the extension of the FMAP is passed.
Well, there's that, and then, but just if we may find things that we need to do just with the health care reform bill, every one of those is going to cost a call for a fiscal note, and
I think
you're overworked already.
I think the best answer, Mr. Chairman, is I'm glad it's March and not May.
Well, thank you, Mr. Hoffman. And so let's get on to thank you very much for both of your testimony. And let's get on to House File 1320. Yeah, and then we're going to vote on this, and I would move
I would move that House File 1320 be recommended to pass and sent to the Finance Committee. Representative Swales.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And we do have a delete-all amendment that came over with language from the Senate. It would be the DE2 amendment.
And then, members, I would move the DE2 amendment, which is a delete-all. Right. All those in favor of the amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? So we now have the that amendment adopted.
And Mr. Chair, this is you do know I'm an English teacher, and since this came from the Senate, I would like to make a grammatical suggestion here. On line 3.17, we need to have subject-verb agreement there, so if we could add an S to the verb pose, then this writer will get an A-minus from me.
So. What was the other one? I see an S after the word pose.
Poses. I believe that would be it, after where, because we have a second amendment, Mr. Chair, the A1, and so in order for the A1 amendment to work correctly, we need to do a subject-verb agreement change so that I'm
My mother was an English teacher as well, and it was a very tough childhood for me.
Just ask my children, Mr. Chair.
We have a marriage of English
teachers. So what is that's the A1 amendment?
There's a second amendment, the A1.
Okay, and so I would move the A1 amendment to the House File 1320 is already amended.
Thank you, Mr.
Any discussion of that? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay, so we think we have the bill the way you want it.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I have become very interested in the issues around epilepsy and drugs that treat epilepsy, and part of it is this December, I was in the middle of teaching my senior English class, and a young man stood up, and he kind of spun around and then fal to the floor and had a grand mal seizure at that time. And I was so proud of my English class because the students immediately moved away furniture from around this boy. Somebody took complete charge and said, let's go outside, sit in the hall. Some of the other kids ran and got the principal, the football coach, and the nurse, and because they knew we would have to lift this young man into a wheelchair. And I realized that this very long seizure that the student experienced also stung him with a certain amount of stigma because he did this in front of his classmates. So I very much appreciate the opportunity to be an advocate for any person that goes through life with this condition, and was just delighted when Mr. Goodnow approached me to carry this particular bill. At this point, Mr. Chair, I do want you to know that this had some controversy around it when it was first introduced in health policy, but since that time, the stakeholders have pulled together, and I have met with those who had concerns. Mr. Goodnow had met as of this morning, and the two amendments actually are the comfort language that's needed so that both sides on this issue feel that they have language that they can live with. But at this point, Mr. Chair, I will let Mr. Goodnow describe the changes to the bill.
And welcome back to the committee, Mr. Goodnow. For those that don't know, Mr. Goodnow, at one point, was chair of this committee.
Mr. Chairman, it's a pleasure to be back and appreciate the opportunity. I am Kevin Goodnow. I'm here on behalf of the Epilepsy Foundation of Minnesota. I am the board president of that organization. The Epilepsy Foundation fully supports House File 1320 and also the amendment that was offered to it, the compromise language. With the compromise language, the fiscal note, any fiscal impact was removed, and we've gotten indications from both the Board of Pharmacy and the Department of Human Services that there's no fiscal impact in the way the bill is currently crafted. What the language does, as amended in the bill, is basically states, it's very simple, it's on the third page, that if the FDA determines that the substitution of drugs for the treatment of epilepsy and seizures pose a risk to the health of epilepsy patients, that the board shall adopt rules with regard to the substitution issue. And so, and then the last part is that if it comes in conflict, and I don't necessarily think that this is going to be the situation, but if it doesn't come in conflict with, those rules come in conflict with the dispensa's written provisions in current statute, that this would supersede, those rules would supersede that. And at the end there, there was a last sentence, was a provision that states that if there's a fiscal cost related to these rules, that it would be a report back to the legislature with regard to the specific costs related to them. And that was comfort language that Senator Berglund asked be added in the Senate Finance Division. So that's the bill in a nutshell. Just wanted to, with the compromises that we've reached, we've had the American Academy of Neurology has supported the bill from the very beginning. The Epilepsy Foundation of Minnesota, of course, has various neurologists and epileptologists throughout the state of Minnesota have also. With the amendments, the Board of Pharmacy has taken a position in support of the bill, as has the Minnesota Association of Pharmacists. And with that last amendment, we've addressed some of the concerns and provided comfort language with the other folks that have opposed the bill in the past. So at this point, I'd stand for any questions that you may have.
Questions? Representative Bunn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Goodenough, if you could just on the line 3.22 of the amendment where they're supposed to, if the proposed rules impacts costs, they're supposed to report that. How would this, you're asking the Board of Pharmacy to do this, wouldn't the increased costs of the state depend on doing some runs, as we say around here, in terms of, you know, how many people in our public programs might take this drug, et cetera? I mean, would they have the my question is, would they have the capacity to calculate to such a thing?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bunn, this language was strongly suggested in the Senate division by Senator Berglund, so we accepted that as it was proposed by her. I do think what would happen would be the Board of Pharmacy would contact DHS to see if there was a potential fiscal impact and get it that way.
Okay. Are there other people? We have Judy Cook and David. They're not going to testify because of the compromise worked out?
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
And so I would renew my motion then that House File 1320, as amended, be recommended to pass and sent to the Finance Committee.
Thank you, Mr.
All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Okay. And my mother's voice is telling me to tell the staff to make sure you add that extra S on line 317.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you,
Mr.
So, thank you. Next, Representative Hosh.
So my swimmer bill.
Representative Hosh.
Mr. Chair, I move House File 3442 to be recommended to pass. Be passed and referred to the Finance Committee, and then I'll move the A1, and then I'll move the A1 amendment too.
Oh, okay. Okay. And where's the A1 amendment? And so you have a A1 amendment, and would you move that, or did you?
Yes, I moved the A1.
Okay.
Amendment.
All those in favor, signify by. saying aye, and I think this is one we can all support.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, will this make the emails stop once and for all?
So all those in favor of the A1 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? That amendment passes. So Representative Hosh.
Mr. Chair, the A1 amendment in the bill in its current form is now probably is a sigh of relief to a lot of folks. As you know, House File 3442 was quite controversial as it discussed a lot of difficult issues, which I hope and I think we are not going to have to consider this legislative session since we've been able to get some better numbers. But we deleted all sections except for Section 13, which is rebasing for nursing homes. We were able to accomplish some of our goals, the ideas, and the discussions that we had. We did get a complete fiscal note today that was posted on the MMB website, so we have that information before the committee. We have different ideas on housing with services densities throughout the state, different private pay rates within our peer groupings for nursing homes, and that's all information I think this committee will be able to find useful. But at the same time, I think we have a responsibility to have folks live in a little bit more peace and not to fear some of the cuts that we had in PCA services, housing with services, dramatic fee increases. So I'm glad we were able to put this bill in its current form and would appreciate the committee support.
Any questions?
Is there
Representative Abler?
So what is the can you just explain what Section 13 does and what it costs?
Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, Section 13 reinstates the rebasing language that we had that was delayed from the last legislative session. So what it does is it tries to rebase rates more reflective of actual costs when it comes to nursing home services.
But does Representative Abler, is there a fiscal note on this then?
Mr. Chair and Representative Abler, there is a fiscal note, and it gets exponentially higher as the years go out. I believe this will come back to our committee, but it needs to be sent to the Finance Committee to be engrossed in the new form.
Oh, I see. Okay. Yep. I just didn't know why I was leaving here. Then. Okay.
So it could be engrossed.
Yep. Any other questions? Seeing none, Representative Hosh renews his motion that House File 3442, as amended, be recommended to pass and sent to the Finance Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? So thank you, Representative Hosh.
Who are we going to do next?
And we're going to skip down. We're going to go to House File 2582, Representative Clark. And I would move House File 2582 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus finance bill. Representative Clark, do you want to describe your bill?
Thank you so much, Mr. Chairman, and I can be quite brief. I do have an amendment that needs to be added based on some information that was brought to me tonight from the department. So it's the A1 amendment, I believe, that you may have being passed out right now.
So, members, I would move the A1 amendment to House File 2582.
Well, Mr. Chairman, there are
passed out, so we're going to have to wait a minute.
Sure.
You can start to describe it.
Okay. Oh, basically, this is bill is before you because last year we passed legislation that said that we wanted to make sure that children who have severe asthma and are eligible for having their physicians, their health care providers, prescribe durable medical equipment for them to help deal with their asthma, which includes things like HEPA cleaners for their homes, allergy bed and pillow encasements, high filtration filters for their furnaces and dehumidifiers. These sort of things that actually make quite a difference in the lives of children who are suffering from asthma. One of the things we learned is that beyond prescribing, making them eligible to get medical assistance to prescribe these particular parts of the equipment that will help them, durable medical equipment, they actually need to have a home visit and a certified asthma educator and public health nurse with asthma management training were the ones we had identified in the bill when it was first passed. We knew they needed this. But we thought there would be already existing in the public health system those kinds of people who could make those visits. And what we learned is that we needed to include them, coverage of their visit in the medical assistance program as well. So we did that, and our first fiscal note said that there was zero cost for that. But I was told tonight that if we are paying those certified asthma educator or public health nurses with that kind of training, we need to actually put this amendment on that you have before you, Mr. Chairman, and it does have a small fiscal note, I believe about $26,000. And so I would ask you to put the amendment on it. That's what the department says makes the bill work. And we do actually have an oral amendment to this amendment based on the English lesson that you talked about earlier. We need to make an amendment here as well. And if you wouldn't mind, Mr. Chairman, if I could just tell you what that is. On line 1.2, if you could just cross out the word first, so it would say the home visit payment, and then it should say rates, so an S on the end of rate. And then we have the amendment as it should be.
Okay, I would move on House File, or excuse me, the A1 amendment that we, on line 1.2, strike the word first, and later on in 1.2, change rate to rates. Any discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? So the bill is now in a form that the chief author wants.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I hope members will support this bill. I think you have a document also in your possession that talks about the incredible savings to families and to the community when we provide these children with this equipment, preventing hospital admissions, emergency room department visits, outpatient office visits. The document you have was actually from a study that was done in Minneapolis, funded by HUD. The Minnesota Department of Health as well did a study a prior year. And if you need some testimony about that, I'd be glad to provide that to you. I think one of the things that's really important to notice is that one of the pieces of evidence we're after in terms of reporting back is that we want to know how much school, how many missed days of school are prevented by this program, Mr. Chairman, because we know that asthma is the number one reason that children miss school. In our state, and if we can reduce their missing school dates, we know we'll also contribute to their education. And in the communities that have a lot of high asthma rates, we also know that the learning gaps are significant as well.
Okay, any further discussion? I don't see any, so we're going to lay this bill over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, committee members.
Next. As amended, yes. And next we'll go to Representative Norton, House File 3056. So I would move House File 3056 be recommended to pass. And is there a cost with this bill?
There is no cost to this bill.
Okay, well then I would move that it be recommended to be passed and sent to the Finance Committee. Representative Norton.
Mr. Chair, could I ask you to move the DE2? There's a delete all 2.
And I would move the DE2 amendment to House File 3056, which is a delete all. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? So we now have the bill ready for the chief author, Representative Norton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members, and I'm really sorry I had to offer the delete all because it does take away some of the strong points of the bill, but we have done it in the spirit of compromise with the department and also trying to align ourselves with the Senate to some extent. This bill was brought to you with three main components. The first is that it modifies some of the dates that the peer grouping language in our health care reform bill 2008. It changes some of those dates. Originally, we had hoped to extend them out a little bit further in trying to allow hospitals to look at the results and make some changes to those results before it was made public. And as part of the compromise with the Department of Health, we have changed those dates, but it's the date changes are primarily to align with their contract with Mathematica and what they were able to do. They've been recently brought on board and couldn't meet the timelines we had in law in 2008, so this extends them out to meet the contract that they have. The second part of the bill ensures, of the delete all, assures that valid and reliable data is released. That really was the impetus for the date changes. We wanted to make certain that as the peer grouping data was released, that hospitals were sure that data was correct and then could work toward making the appropriate changes to improve quality. right now, that isn't going to happen because the dates are remaining the way they are, but we are asking that reliable and valid data is released to the public, and so we put some language in there, and I will, just in full disclosure, say that we are working with the department on that. I know there's a part they'll probably address here in a few moments that they still have concerns with in the language that we've brought forward. So we will continue to work with them between now and when this goes to the floor to make certain that all parties are comfortable with that. We just don't have exactly quite the language that we'd like yet. And the last part of the bill repeals the 10% requirement for prohibition of providers from serving public programs. The 10% is an arbitrary number. We don't, in fact, know, and I talked about this in the Healthcare Policy Committee, if all the data comes back and everyone was grouped very similarly, that to drop the lower 10% off, if there's no statistical significance for that 10%, just doesn't make sense. So for now, we're going to repeal that, and it may be something we'd look at in the future, but I think that those are the main points, and if anyone would like to ask questions or go through the dates, I'd be happy to talk about those further. And we have Dave Renner here from MMA, who is also available to answer questions.
Questions? Representative Abler.
I like where you're going with this whole idea and, this reliability business. I remember that from a different hearing we talked about. By the way, my plan doesn't hurt anybody who doesn't deserve it. But on this thing here, have you talked to the department, and is this a direction they're willing to go? Does that testimony?
Mr. Golden or Dr. Golden is going to come up.
Oh, okay.
And testify.
We have been working with them, and in fact, they didn't testify at our first hearing here in the House when it was in policy, but did then, because of some concerns as they've thought about it further, did go to the Senate and worked with the Senate for some language, which is the language that we adopted here with this little reliable and valid language that we're still trying to work out what should be in law. We're not in complete agreement yet, but we're getting close.
And Mr. Chair, this is really a way better way than it was going before. Because right now, no one knows anything about their data. It's like you don't know if you're working good or bad or indifferent. So this is a great bill.
Representative Broad.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Representative Norton. I think this is moving in the right direction. I appreciate it. I think one thing I'd like to see us work toward is that, the governor has a proposal that actually moves us toward using peer grouping for public programs. And I think as we get better information related to the quality statistics and the cost and quality and things along those lines, we can start moving in the direction to help us lower costs overall for the public programs as well. And so I hope at some point we can start meshing those two things. I think, making sure that we have correct data on which to make good, solid decisions is a good idea. And from there, we can leap into the governor's proposal, I hope, which I think makes a lot of sense down the road.
Hey, Mr. Renner.
Mr. Chair, members, Dave Renner with the Minnesota Medical Association. A couple of comments. One is just in response to Representative Broad. We're not necessarily opposed to what you're saying. We have some concerns, especially with our low payment rates currently under our public programs, how those will work. But I want to just point you to Section 3 of the bill, which is current law. We are changing some of the timelines just to comply with the department's other timelines. But there still is language in current law that does allow Department of Human Services to create a payment system to reward high quality, low cost, which I think is trying to get what you're getting to. Mr. Chair, and just in response to Representative Abler's questions, all the dates that you see in the bill are from the Department of Health's contract they have with Mathematica and other work and their work plan they put forward. This is something that, from the Medical Association point of view, we strongly believe that we wanted further delays to make sure people are comfortable. We will concede that we did not get those. So as Representative Norton indicated, the language we are trying to put in about validity and reliability we think is crucial before this gets reported out, that we ensure that this is high-quality data. And so from the Medical Association point of view, we still think this is a move in the right direction.
Representative Rood and then Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Norton. And I apologize, you maybe spoke to this, but in the amendment, I'm just reading it over when it talks about providers may be given any data for which they are the subject of the data, and they have 30 days to review it. Do they know when the data is out there? Does it also come to them? Do they have to request it? How does that work?
Mr. Chair and Representative Rood, Very good question. We don't know yet because this data is in the process of being gathered. They're working with an organization, Maine, to gather it. They've just signed a contract, I believe, within the last month with Mathematica. They're now in the process of developing the methodology and how the data will be used for peer grouping. But according to the law, providers are required to be given their own data. We had some concern about the 30-day period, whether that's long enough. So we did add some clarification that the 30-day is not only to review it, but to initiate an appeal. But as we said in the policy committee, for most providers, even the large integrated systems, they have never seen this kind of data before, and most of them want to see this kind of data. But for especially the smaller clinics, it's going to be a challenge for them to be able to understand this data. According to the timelines that are in the department's contract, providers will be given the data, at least on total costs, no later than October 15th. And then on January 1 of 2011, it will be now publicly, that's on page 2, lines 26, line 16, excuse me, it will now be publicly reported on January 1 of 2011. So providers will have basically 2.5 months to be able to understand this. We still have a concern that for small groups, they will not have enough time to really understand how this means, how this works. So that's why we think it's crucial to have some additional language talking about that this has to be scientifically valid and reliable. And there is language that the department did put in to say that if we are not meeting those scientifically valid criteria, there is the ability to further delay if need be. And we think that's important.
Representative Liebling and then Representative Gottwald. Oh, he's got his answer.
That was my question.
Representative Liebling.
Thanks, Mr. Chair, and just, it looks reasonable to me. I'm just wondering what the repealer is, and maybe you said that and I didn't catch it. What's the repealer?
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, the repealer is the 10% rule, which was going to automatically disallow the lower 10% from being able to provide services for the public programs. And so we're repealing that for now. And again, as I said, I think everyone would be willing to look at that if there was huge disparities in the future. But I think without having the information and looking at it, we could be setting ourselves up for hurting 10% of our providers every year. Without a real valid reason to do so. And Mr. Chair, I would just say one of the reasons I was pleased to be able to carry this is because of my involvement in education. And we watched No Child Left Behind, and even before that, some of the earlier data where we held school districts immediately accountable when they didn't even know the cut score. So the cut score was told to them, and they were given their rank as to how they had done at the same time. And it was really quite unfair to schools who, I think would have benefited, all of us would have benefited, and our children would have benefited, had they been given the score and a year to fix the issues before they were then publicly scrutinized. And so this isn't giving them the time that I had hoped we'd be able to give them, but I think it does ease my conscience or my mind a little bit with the 2008 reforms without changing anything terribly and still keeping the quality in the forefront.
I would say, given our reimbursement rates, that they might want to be in the lower 10%.
Mr. Chairman,
that's another issue.
Mr. Chairman, when we have talked to our membership about this bottom 10%, they have raised that question. It creates some unique incentives. Do I want to be a high cost, low quality, so I no longer are allowed to participate in these programs? I don't think that was the intent. And that's why and just to make sure everybody's clear, that bottom 10% language was not part of the original 2008 legislation. That was added in last year, very late, without much discussion. And our understanding is there's a number of people who are not quite certain how we will even implement that language. So that's another reason we think we're not quite ready to go that direction.
Representative Broad.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Chairman, then I think you'd be very interested in the governor's proposal, actually the proposal that I've been carrying for him, because in the governor's proposal, he provides for a provider tiering opportunity. And with that provider tiering, they actually give an incentive to the high-quality, low-cost tier. And that incentive is an incentive in the way of an increase in the rates. And so in order to make sure that we get people in the right category, having good data makes sense, and then we can shift people into the opportunity to get those increased rates if they are providing high-quality, low-cost care for our public program. So I do think these things kind of mesh well together. And so, Mr. Chairman, I hope that you'll give my bill a second look, because it really does fit well with what you were just saying.
Well, I would like that part of it. Mr. Golden, do you want
to... Mr. Chairman, duly noted.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee members, for the record, my name is Jim Golden with the Department of Health. I would like to thank Representative Norton and Mr. Renner for working with the department to address some of the concerns that we had in their original bill. We have talked quite a bit, and we have come to quite a bit of agreement. You know, we do have one small concern that we are working with them to try to resolve. Just for the committee's information, we are concerned about the language that is on lines 3.7 and 3.8 that puts in specific thresholds for the reliability. I think that the department is as concerned as anybody that the data that is produced and made public is both valid and reliable. We did add the other language that allows us to delay if we have concerns about the reliability or the validity of the data. What our specific concern with this is that there will be a number of public work groups which providers, purchasers, consumers, and others, as well as many experts related to this type of work, will be involved in to help develop it. What we are concerned about is that any measure of reliability needs to be suitable and appropriate for the types of analysis and results that are being produced. And so we simply would, we're working with them to try to find a way to ensure that whatever we have is consistent with our results and that the thresholds make sense for the specific types of analysis that are done. And that is the concern that we are still working to resolve with them.
Representative Abler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And on the theory of what's good for the goose is good for the gander, I think if you're going to give criteria performance to the providers, maybe the department should be given the same kind of scoring opportunities to have to comply. So just meant to be a little humorous for you. But I think in
absolutely.
But I do just with the version I came forward, I didn't rely on tiering and prices, and you heard my bill last week, but which talks about only the highest cost ones, and so I have less risk of impugning people's character. But on this whole topic, you're well aware about all the risk adjustment issues, and there's a ton of data about driving people away from hard cases that you don't want to do. And so I joke about it here, but it's something that it's on your mind. I hope your work groups are solid on that and that you don't cause unintended consequences. And like in New York and some of the states where they just to keep their stats good, they avoided certain kinds of cases. And so I'm just to remind you about what you already know. So thank you.
Okay, any further discussion? Seeing none, I would renew my motion that House File 3056 be recommended to pass and sent to the Finance Committee. As amended. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
The bill is passed as amended.
Yes, and
it's
a minute.
Oh, yeah.
Representative Fritz moves the approval of how many sets of minutes? Three. Do you want to comment on any particular one you found more intriguing than the others? Okay. Thank you. Who was naughty and nice? All in favor of those, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? There being two ayes and no nays, the minutes are adopted. Representative Huntley moves House Law 3279 be doing what? Recommended to pass. And moving off to finance.
Okay, Mr. Chair, first of all, I have to complain about the chair making me wait till the very end of this hearing.
I'm sorry there.
Most of you have heard this committee in the, or this bill in the policy. It relates to having our information, health information exchange meet federal requirements. If we meet those requirements, then our providers over the next number of years will get someplace between $400 and $800 million in extra payments from Medicare. So it's, I think it's very important that we do this. There was some controversy with this bill. Obviously, there's controversy with the privacy issue, but there's nothing in this bill relates to the changes any of our laws, and our laws on privacy protection are stricter than most other states. And are there amendments?
Yeah.
And I have a there was another controversy. Does this take care of you? Is this the good news?
Yep, this is good.
Okay, and you may remember, at least those were on the policy committee, that there was a group called MedNet, which is a Twin Cities computer company that actually does the northeastern Minnesota computer work for the group up there that has created an information exchange. And they were unhappy with some of the things the department had done in the past, and I don't want to go back to the past. I'd rather talk about the future. And they thought that there was some favoritism towards a Twin Cities group that was doing the same thing. Those issues have been addressed with this amendment, and so this would be the I would move the A-10 amendment. And this is a Peace in the Valley amendment. And Mr. Golden can describe that.
Well, maybe while we're on the topic, Dr. Golden, can you just comment on what, just the short version of what helped the MedNet thing to get resolved, just the bird's eye summary of that, and then you can go through the amendment if you like.
Mr. Chair and committee members, I can. There are a number of aspects of the amendment that I think helped come to resolution with MedNet. So, for example, if you look on lines 217 and 218 of the agreement, of the amendment, there's a line in there about reciprocal agreements. Reciprocal agreements are basically the agreements that exist between health information organizations. So, for example, between CHIC up in northern Minnesota and MNHI in the Twin Cities. And what they do is, what this says is that that reciprocal agreement must include comparable quality of service standards that ensure equitable levels of service. What that's really saying is that when they connect to each other and pass data back and forth, you can't intentionally slow down the other organization's data where you might have some control as it's passing across your network. These are very standard types of agreements, for example, with internet service providers, so that in the internet you can't slow down a competitor's information as it traffics across your network. If you look at lines 224 through 230, this requires the commissioners of health and human services to provide access to their data or services essentially on an equal basis, so that any HIO can connect directly to the departments of health and human services at the same price, kind of equal access. This ensures that we can't favor one particular organization. Another example would be lines 232 through 3.2. For those pieces of data and those transactions that are required for the hospitals and clinics to be able to get their meaningful use funding from Medicare and Medicaid, this requires that state agencies provide equal access to any data or transactions that would be necessary to that. And then the final issue that we addressed specifically for MedNet is on lines 327 through 331. And what that is saying is, to the degree that we are, have the opportunity to apply for additional federal funding to support the development and maintenance of state-level health information exchange, we will ensure that we do that through an open process that would allow any of these entities the opportunity to raise funding. Mr. Chair, the other thing that we did that helped both with MedNet as well as an organization called CHIC that is up in Representative Huntley's district is that there was previously, when it was in the policy committee, a health information exchange oversight board. And as you may recall, there were a couple of issues associated with the board. There were a lot of questions that, for example, Representative Loeffler raised with regard to conflict of interest. There were also some concerns about the overall fees that were in the bill. And so what we have done is we have taken out the board. We have assigned the same responsibilities to the Commissioner of Health. And then to ensure an open and transparent process, if you look at lines 115 through 127, it requires that before we certify any organization, we are required to hold public hearings. As part of the public hearings, the applicant is required to come and do a presentation with regard to their application. And they are also required to respond to questions from interested parties, whether that would be consumers, hospitals, or physicians, or others. The other thing to ensure openness is all aspects of the application need to be made available 10 days prior to the hearing, so people have the opportunity to see that and to think about what their issues might be. After the hearing, we need to compile the feedback and recommendations from stakeholders who participated and make that publicly available prior to issuing a certificate. And then finally, we are required to consult with hospitals, physicians, and other types of professionals who are eligible either for Medicare or Medicaid incentives or penalties down the road, as well as their respective statewide associations. So this was to restore in some of the transparency that was lost with the board going out. The net result of taking out that board was to be able to reduce the overall cost of the system by 30%. And so if you look at lines 320 through 323, what you will see is that there is a 30% reduction across the board in all of the fees, which was also an issue that was raised not only by CHIC and MedNet, but also by a variety of other organizations as well.
Well, thank you. Any questions from the members? Representative Liebling.
And then thank you, Mr. Chair. It's not so much a question. I just, since I'm on the policy committee and we heard this and we heard all the concerns, and I know we had a long discussion, I just wanted to thank you for working this out and you know, taking obviously a lot of time to do that, because the concerns that were expressed and that you've addressed here weren't even part of the bill. And I know we had that as we were listening, we were realizing that there were concerns that were kind of a little bit peripheral to the actual bill that was being discussed at that time. So I appreciate your making it part of the discussion and getting it resolved for us. Thank you.
And Dr. Golden, I'll echo that too. I was going to say that earlier, but she said it great. So thank you for doing that. Representative Gottwell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Dr. Golden. I also appreciate the work you've done on the bill. I know it's been a long roll over the last couple of years and a lot of concerns about privacy and so forth. I do have a question about the expedited rulemaking and why we're doing that. What is the rush? Is it a federal funding timing matchup thing? And then you and I had a conversation that maybe you could put on the record here about the opt-in, opt-out piece.
Dr. Golden.
Mr. Chair, committee members, one of the other things that was removed as part of the amendment is, in fact, the expedited rulemaking that is in the bill that is removed on, well, which line is it here, 6.8? That is...
What was that, 16.8? It's 16.8 in the bill.
That is 16.8, but I don't see it.
Subdivision 5. And then you're saying it's been taken out. Right? Page 16.
Line 3.3.
Right.
Page 14. No, that's not the rulemaking, though.
No.
Rulemaking is on page 16.
It's 16.8.
You have to improve your amendment to include that? You want to phone a friend?
I'm not seeing it.
I do want to phone a friend, Mr. Chair.
I'm not seeing it in the amendment.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gottwald, neither am I. I actually thought it was in the amendment to remove it. We did, Mr. Chair, Representative Gottwald, the reason that I thought it was removed is we did remove it in the Senate side, and I thought that it was removed in this amendment. So,
Dr. Gold, we can actually improve your amendment to include that. It can be an oral amendment from the author, but you can make the motion, Representative Gottwald, if you want to move to delete 16.8 to 16.11. Is that your motion?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
And Representative Huntley would like to incorporate that, perhaps, in his amendment?
Yeah, I would just incorporate that.
Okay, so the motion is to delete lines 16.8 to 16.11. That's the Gottwald motion. Incorporate it in the Huntley motion, Huntley amendment. Everybody understand that? Mm-hmm. Any more questions about the amendment? Not to rush you along, but is there any questions? Mm-hmm. Anybody in the audience want to talk about this amendment? It's was kind of a big deal. And besides Mr. Goodnow, want to talk about it, I guess. Welcome to the committee again.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you. I'm Kevin Goodnow, and I'm here representing MedNet tonight, and just wanted to reiterate what everybody said, is that we have reached agreement with regard to the issues that were raised. Let me clarify that. There's two issues, and it's been noted that there are some issues relative to something that happened in the past. Those have not been resolved by this, and that's fine, because we're dealing with issues going forward and what's actually covered by this legislation. With regard to issues and improvements that we could see in this legislation, those improvements have been made, and we really do appreciate the Department of Health and Dr. Golden in particular in working with us in addressing those concerns. So we're fully supportive of the bill with the amendment going on.
You have a question here. Representative Gottwald.
Let's vote on the amendment first.
Okay. Anybody else want to testify about this? Anybody else? Any other comments? Seeing none, all in favor of the amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Amendment's adopted. Representative Gottwald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Dr. Golden, if you could just comment on the opt-in, opt-out piece. I think that was an important piece of our conversation. I think it might be worth putting on the record.
Dr. Golden.
Mr. Chair and committee members, what Representative Gottwald is talking about is a conversation we had earlier where we had a conversation about some of the privacy aspects that have been raised as this has traveled through the committees. The first thing is that this bill does not change any of the privacy requirements that are currently in statute. And in fact, one of the requirements of any of these organizations is that as part of their application process, they have to demonstrate that they are in compliance with all state and federal privacy and security requirements. Additionally, there were some questions that existed with regard to consent. And generally speaking, in Minnesota, you need patient's consent in order to exchange any information, even if it is going from a hospital or provider to another hospital or provider. The exceptions to that are things such as medical emergency, which is defined into statute. So even with this bill, while this talks about how the exchange will occur, it still is going to require a patient's consent in Minnesota. So that is essentially a consent in to move any information. The one exception to that is actually something that is in statute that is called a record locator service. And what a record locator service is, it is essentially an index that helps a hospital or provider identify where a patient's records are. So it is not the actual patient's record, but it says, for example, Jim Golden's records is at CentraCare, or it is at St. Mary's Duluth Clinic. And so that would then allow the hospital or clinic to talk with that hospital in order to be able to get those records electronically. And what Minnesota statute allows in that case is hospitals and other providers may populate the index. For a provider to then be able to access that, they need the patient's consent. And as part of that consent process, the consent requires that there is an explicit opt-out, which would allow the patient to fully opt out of that record locator.
Representative Gottwald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, Dr. Golden, also I know the concern I've heard from providers is, and we discussed this a little bit too, the ability to rely on, okay, this is the system we're going to invest thousands and thousands of dollars in, and it's going to be the system, this is the horse we're definitely going to ride in this electronic information exchange environment. I don't know that this directly addresses that, but anything you can tell us to give us some comfort on that.
Dr. Golden.
Mr. Chair and Representative Gottwald, I can. As part of the stimulus package, there are a variety of responsibilities that are situated in spots Some are at the federal government, some are at the state. And one of the key responsibilities of the federal government is to set the standards and the certification process for all electronic health records across all various settings, as well as modules that are there. So the advantage of having that set at the federal level is that that way the vendors are able to build their product according to one set of national standards that are certified. And so what we have been advising various providers is to watch very carefully, and we point them to the spots where to watch what is happening with federal standards and certification. We also recommend that they always ask vendors, are they going to comply with those certifications, because that is really what you want to do. Those will evolve over time. We expect that the vendors will continue to upgrade and adapt their products to those standards, but as long as they are doing that, they will be on a stable path with regard to certification and standard technologies.
Representative Gottwald.
So, Mr. Chair, Dr. Golden, you'd have kind of a federal good housekeeping seal of approval on the products these vendors are producing that would assure the providers that this horse is riding on the same track.
Dr. Golden.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gottwald, not only will they have a good housekeeping seal, in order to be eligible for Medicare and Medicaid incentives, they have to be using one of those products that actually has that good housekeeping seal on it. And for that reason, most reputable vendors would not deviate from those standards because their clients would not be eligible for Medicare or Medicaid incentives.
Any further discussion? Last words, Jefferson Huntley? Not in your life, just on this bill.
No, thank you, Mr. Chair, and let's have a vote.
All right. Well, I thought you had some great closing wrap-up thing you had all rehearsed. All in favor of moving this on to finance, please say aye. As amended. Aye. All opposed. Whatever. There's more yeses than
no.
Before you leave, would you please put your House Bill 37, the three bills you didn't hear today, 3713, 3250, and 3047 in your packets. The saves. And okay. And until that, we're going to be adjourned until 30 minutes after session tomorrow. Good night.